This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor What the Festival, July 26th through 28th, 2013, at Wolf Run Ranch in Oregon. Featuring over 50 electronic and dance artists, including Purity Ring, A-Track, RJD2, and Tycho, as well as on-site art installations, a hookah lounge, and splash pool. That's July 26th through 28th, 2013, at Wolf Run Ranch in Oregon. Tickets on sale now at whatthefestival.com.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9 a.m. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on One Land Many Voices, hosts Zaha Hassan and Ned Roche speak with local retired physician Bonnie Reagan about her trip to the Middle East. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an update on the Bradley Manning trial, and at 11, Rosalie Regal talks about her life as an oral historian and activist. This is all coming up this morning on Progressive Talk Radio for Portland, KBOO.
Morning. That was a track titled Singing from the album Ala Fan from Palestinian musical group Sabreen. The lyrics are taken from Egyptian poet Saeed Hijab. My name is Zaha Hassan.
And I'm Ned Roche. And you're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
On this morning's show, we'll be talking about the experience of Jewish Americans and understanding their relationship to the Israel-Palestine conflict. A growing number of Jewish Americans are identifying with the Palestinian struggle for justice and equal rights, as Palestine is recognized as one of the world's most important human rights struggles today. In standing in solidarity with Palestinians, many of these Jews are reimagining and reclaiming their connection to the Jewish commitment of justice, justice thou shalt pursue. To these Jews, there is an understanding that their own liberation is intimately connected to the liberation of the Palestinian people. Many American Jews grew up understanding stories colored by films like Exodus, starring Paul Newman, with a building out of the ashes of the Holocaust, of a nation where Jews could finally be free and safe, a 2,000-year-old dream come true. But even decades before Israel came into being in 1948, Zionist leaders in the U.S. were telling Jewish Americans that it was imperative that they support the establishment of the State of Israel in Palestine. Every Jewish home had a little blue and white tin called a pushki, and children dropped coins in it so that the Jewish National Fund could buy land and to plant trees in Palestine for a Jewish state.
With the horrific atrocities of the Holocaust, the support for a Jewish state swelled among Jews worldwide, and especially in the U.S. Now, more than 60 years after the State of Israel was founded, organizations like AIPAC and J Street continue to argue that being a Jew means supporting Israel. And in synagogues across the country, young Jews making the rite of passage from youth to adulthood during bat and bar mitzvah ceremonies often stand before an Israeli flag and are handed a certificate to take an all-expenses-paid birthright trip to Israel. Today, on One Land, Many Voices, we'll be exploring how American Jews have been raised to conflate their Jewishness with unconditional support for Israel, and how it might be possible to separate the two so that being Jewish becomes the catalyst for Jewish action in support of human rights in Palestine, Israel. I know this has been a journey I've had to take in my own life as an American Jew, a journey that absolutely changed my life, and one I want to share with listeners today. But we'll also be talking with Bonnie Reagan, who just returned from a powerful experience in Israel-Palestine. Bonnie is a family physician, now retired, who's been involved in social justice causes all her life. She had a traditional Jewish education growing up in New Jersey and is interested in the cultural and historical aspects of Judaism. Her grandparents emigrated to the United States around 1900 after enduring pogroms in Ukraine, and as a part of coming to terms with her family history, Bonnie took a trip to each of the towns and cities that her four grandparents left. Though Bonnie was brought up by a mother who was a peace and human rights advocate, the conflict in Israel-Palestine was not something she'd ever studied or thought about in much depth. Not until, that is, her trip to the Middle East for the first time this spring with her husband, Pete. Welcome, Bonnie, to One Land, Many Voices.
Thank you for having me.
Bonnie, all four of your grandparents fled anti-Semitic persecution and came to the U.S. Talk about your own Jewish roots and your Jewish upbringing.
My grandparents were all Orthodox Jews. They actually spoke Yiddish, and my mother, I think, learned Yiddish as her primary language, didn't learn English till she went to school. And they were so Orthodox that I didn't end up having a bat mitzvah because they wouldn't have come, because they didn't travel on the Sabbath. But I did, I went to Hebrew school three times a week for 10 years, all the way into my middle school or early high school years. And then I fell in love with a non-Jew, which created lots of family strife. So I ended up separating myself from the education after that, actually, although I had completed my education.
Was your education, did it also include an education about Israel? Was that part of your upbringing?
To some extent. I mean, we didn't have the little tin in our house, but I remember giving money for trees, for trees to be planted in Israel. But it was more, we had a rabbi, it was a conservative, my grandparents were Orthodox, my parents were conservative Jews, and it was more, actually it was more exploring the cultural and historical and religious aspects of Judaism. And that's why I stayed. Neither my sister and my brother did the education that I did. I think I was just so curious about what our background was.
And tell us about the messages you got around Zionism, around Israel, and the connection you felt as a young person to the state of Israel.
Well, it's interesting because I had cousins who lived in Philadelphia. My family moved to New Jersey, and I think my cousins were raised in quite a bit more Zionist households than I was, because I don't actually remember hearing a lot about Israel, per se. I mean, we did things for Israel, like the trees. That's what I remember. But there was really more emphasis on other things. My mother was a peace activist, and she was more concerned at the time, I believe, about the Vietnam War and African-American civil rights and things like that. Those are the things I remember more.
And when things would come up in the news when you're watching TV, and then, of course, it's like a regular occurrence on the nightly news to see some issue with Israel, Lebanon, Israel, the Palestinians, or Israel, Jordan, like, how did those moments affect you, if at all, or were they just sort of another conflict zone in the world that you just sort of took note of?
I think I found it very confusing. It was very hard to sort out, and I think I'm going to guess that I reflect the confusion that my mom felt, because she was never, oh, this person's right or that person's right. She wasn't that kind of a person anyway, but she, unless people's rights were being trampled, then she was, you know, saying that's wrong. But I don't remember having a clear-cut idea of how you were supposed to feel about Israel.
I know I bring this up because I know for me the first moments I felt Palestinian was growing up and then seeing some incident on the news. For me, that moment was when I was 11 and the reports of the Sabra and Shatila massacre happened in Lebanon. And then all of a sudden I was like, what's going on? And how could people let this happen? And And then that was sort of the catalyst to make me learn, even at the age of 11, you know, what does it mean to be Palestinian, and why isn't there more of an uproar about this? So I'm wondering how, like, similar events translated for you coming from the other perspective. Or did they just, was that just like, you know, your connection was so limited at that point that you didn't feel like that had anything to do with you at all?
Yeah, I learned about what you're talking about, those massacres, but I didn't learn about them until I was an adult. And I either erased those memories
yeah.
about the conflicts, or they weren't real strong.
Okay.
And as an adult, prior to taking this recent trip of yours, were there times where the issue of Israel and Palestine came up that you just felt either uncomfortable or unsure or undecided about where you stood in the conflict? Was there ever a queasy feeling inside? And if so, why?
Yeah, there definitely was. I have a cousin who was raised in Philadelphia, and she was raised in a very Zionist home. Her father was my mom's favorite brother, actually, but it was amazing how differently we were raised. And she ended up moving to Israel with her two daughters as a single mom when she was 35 and the kids were 5 and 8 years old, and still lives there. And over the years, when we've seen her in the United States, she's invited us to come visit her. And I always felt a huge amount of resistance, not a little, really a lot. And I think it was because of the Palestinian-Israeli conflicts, and I didn't really know very much about them, very deeply about them. And I felt very, very uncomfortable about it, because I felt like, you know, just as Zaha had said earlier, that that you hear in the newspaper or on the radio about some of the real major conflicts, and you know, first you feel one way, then you feel the other way. You know, the suicide bombers, that's bad. The Israelis making the settlements, that's bad. You know, and I was really very confused about, you know, how to tease out the truth of what was going on there.
I'm wondering, like, Ned, because you grew up in a much more Zionist household. Was it different for you then? Was it something more visceral when you'd hear something in the news, regardless of what it was about? Did you feel like you needed to take a side one way or another? How was it for you?
Yeah, for me, it was fairly different from what Bonnie is describing. I grew up in a home where our connection to Judaism was very intense, but it was only outdone by our allegiance to Israel and to Zionism. And I was a teenager when the 1967 war happened, and that was a moment that was a turning point for many Jews in this country, where for the first time, post-Holocaust, Jews felt there was something to be proud of. And Jews puffed up their chests, and Jews had defeated, they felt, so many Arab armies, and wasn't this fantastic? And the job that maybe was not finished in 1948, well, now it was done. Jews controlled all of historic Palestine. And for me, I felt a tremendous connection to the Zionist project, you know, I was raised to believe and felt it so deeply that Israel was the manifestation of thousands of years of Jewish history, finally culminating in the rebirth of a nation after a couple of thousand years, and the rebirth of a language that had been dormant ever since basically the Bible. And that was rekindled, and Jews from all over the world came to live in this country, and there was an excitement about that. And part of that was because in that narrative of the Jews making the desert bloom and a land without a people for a people without a land, there was never any discussion or mention or awareness of the indigenous population. So I certainly didn't grow up hating Palestinians. I wasn't taught to hate Palestinians, but Palestinians were irrelevant. They This was a story about the Jewish people, and it was a grand epic story of Jewish history, and the Palestinians just happened to be in the way. And that was, for me, an enormous turning point in my own evolution around this issue when I started to meet Palestinians and realized that, in fact, there was a story that I just didn't know very much about.
So you came to learn that there were Palestinians living there. At what point did you have that realization? And then what happened for you at that point? How did your relationship change then to...
Well, I actually received a scholarship to work on a kibbutz in Israel after my senior year of high school, and I loved the experience. And that kibbutz happened to be very close to Deir Yassin, which was a Palestinian village that a horrible massacre took place in 1948 by Jewish soldiers. But this kibbutz, the whole time I was there, there was never a mention of Deir Yassin. And to me, that was, in a way, very common, that what we learned about Israel was a Jewish story. And again, if a massacre happened to Palestinians, it just wasn't important. It just wasn't part of the story that we needed to know to feel good about this project and to continue working on it. So for me, I loved my kibbutz experience, and I went back to Hebrew University in Jerusalem for my junior year of college. And there I was, a political science major in Jerusalem. And now I look back and I think to myself, what was I thinking? Why didn't I see the contradictions between the mythology of Israel being this pretty incredible place, the only democracy in the Middle East and so on, and the reality of what Israel meant in the lives of the indigenous people of Palestine. And it was in my senior year of college that I had, for me, one of those significant moments where a Palestinian, I actually found myself for some, at the time, inexplicable reason, drawn to the Arab students on campus. And this one Palestinian friend of mine said to me, okay, so here's the challenge I want to lay before you. You are a nice liberal Jew, and your understanding from what you've shared with me is that there are two sides to this story, two legitimate claims, two peoples with rights in the land, and that's the problem, that there are two competing claims. So he said to me, what I challenge you to do is to try to come up with one historical account of what actually happened, not two different perspectives, but do some research and find out for yourself what really happened. And for me, I think that was what set me off on really one of the remarkable journeys of my life that helped me see a reality very different from what I grew up with, and in many ways impacted who I am today, not just on this issue, but on every political issue.
So it's that interpersonal connection that you make that really makes the difference. And that's what I really want to explore with you, Bonnie, is that, okay, so you came from this, you know, background where you had some kind of admiration, respect mm-hmm. for the state of Israel, not necessarily a real strong Zionist background like Ned did. But yet you got to this point where you were going to travel to Israel for, was it a family reunion of some?
Oh, it was to see my cousin and her daughter.
To see your cousin. And yet you couldn't imagine yourself going without visiting the Palestinians and meeting Palestinians. Why was that?
I am a believer in learning about situations and really trying to get a good view of what has happened historically and what the different points of view are. I remember the first time I went to Hawaii, I read about the history of Hawaii and the American takeover of the native population while everybody else was lying on the sand reading novels. It's just who I am. I'm curious about how things get to be the way they are and what's going on. So having heard a lot in the last number of years about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and caring a lot about human rights for everyone, I had to learn about different points of view. I would be very uncomfortable going there and not learning about that. My cousin and I actually had an argument by email before I went, where she said, "This is who I am," and I said, "Well, this is who I am." She actually told me I was corrupt and biased.
Because you dared to ask.
Because I dared to ask, and I kind of let that go and thought, well, I'll try to learn her point of view as well, you know, because I didn't have her point of view. And so I was trying to learn everybody's point of view, including hers. And so she was part of it, and I ended up getting a guide in Israel who her daughter recommended, and I told her daughter, who was a more nuanced person, that I needed somebody who wasn't dogmatic. I needed somebody who had a sense of there being lots of different points of view. And we did end up getting a guide that was great for Israel. But then I contacted Rabbi Joey Wolf, and he put me in contact with someone who put me in contact with Zaha.
So there's our disclaimer there. Then.
There's our disclaimer. And you recommended actually a Palestinian family-owned hotel in East Jerusalem. And contrary to both what the guide and my cousin recommended, I stayed at that hotel because I wanted right from the start to have kind of my foot in a couple different camps and to be able to see different side, you know, a more nuanced point of view, different points of view. And then I spent a week, we spent a week in Israel with the Israeli guide or with my cousin and her family.
Well, let's start there. Tell me about it was 5 days you spent touring with the Israeli guide. Is that correct?
Yeah, or a week, something like that. Yeah.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, and our guest today is Bonnie Reagan, who recently returned from the West Bank and from Israel and is recounting some of her journey.
Tell us where you went for those 5 days, because I think it's very telling how it starts out and the places you go. And I'm curious to see what the Israeli guide was telling you as you were going to these locations.
Yeah, we started out in Jerusalem, and we saw the historic stuff. We did we looked at the Jewish historical areas, the Muslim historical areas, and the Christian. So we did the Via Dolorosa.
So you were inside the old city, the walled
city. We were mostly inside. Yeah, and the hotel I stayed at was the Jerusalem Hotel, which was only a block and a half from the Jaffa Gate, or the Damascus Gate, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were very close to the old city. We went to the Western Wall, and that was interesting for me because I had no idea what I would feel when I was there, but what I felt, what I thought about was my grandparents and how they had never been to Israel. My grandparents emigrated to the United States and never went to Israel. And I just felt their courageousness for leaving their own country and their own homes because of discrimination. Then we went to Yad Vashem and the Holocaust Museum, and that was particularly interesting to me. My husband had lived in Germany for a year, and I visited Germany, but also just the history of Ukraine. And after I was in Ukraine the first time, for the following year or 2 years, I read about World War II as much as I could about the conflict there. And then we went to the Garden of the Righteous of the Nations with a woman whose mother was listed there. And then when we went to the...
What is that garden?
The Righteous of the Nations is the are the non-Jews who saved Jews during the Holocaust. And so her mother was a non-Jew who actually saved her father, who was a Jew, in Switzerland, I believe. And the most amazing thing about Yad Vashem was the children's memorial. Which was created by the parents of a child who had died in the Holocaust.
Is that the Points of Light?
That's the Hall of Mirrors with the Point of Light.
Yeah, I visited there too.
It's very moving.
Powerful, yeah.
Yeah. We went to, the most fun thing we did was to go to the archaeological dig at Beit Guvrin, the national park, and find pieces of 2,000-year-old pottery.
And what was your guide telling you about that location, about the archaeological dig area? Anything historical? Anything more recent?
She said, well, no, 2,000 years ago, the people were expelled from their homes, mm-hmm. and they threw their goods down into their basements, and that's what the archaeological area is, actually. It's
which people?
You know what?
I'm just wondering.
I don't remember. There were pieces of Egyptian pottery, but do you remember, Ned? It's people that were there. I believe the Maccabees attacked them. And actually, our guide told us that Maccabees were
I know it's a very,
not very,
very old location,
lovely people.
With lots of layers of people in history throughout the years, Jewish, Christian, Muslim. So
we went to Ben-Gurion's grave and into the desert. And we went on a camel ride, and we went to the Dead Sea and Masada.
You've got
to
do the camel ride.
I actually had a great camel that liked to dance. And every time he danced to the left, this other camel would put its nuzzle up against my knee and nuzzle my knee. It was pretty funny.
You're really going native there with a camel. So
we went to Masada, and I had heard of Masada. I always heard it was a place of great heroism, but it was actually a more, it was a complicated place as well, and very different than what I expected. And we went to the Dead Sea, which was the first time I ever floated in my life.
Yeah, pretty traditional and very probably moving to you, I would imagine, to see, like, to start off seeing the old walled city, because I know every time I see that place, it's just like, huh, you know?
Yeah, it's very powerful.
Magical, almost. And then seeing, you know, Yad Vashem and sort of getting that connection to why you need this Israel, because look at what history has, you know, shown the Jewish people. And then going to Nahal Gavrim, right, the archaeological dig and feeling a part of that history. I mean, actually digging with the archaeologists there and finding things.
That's
it's an amazing feeling, right? My son would love that.
Yeah.
he wants to be a paleontologist, so that would have been a treat for him. And then going to Ben-Gurion's grave, right, Negev, in the Negev, or the Nakab, as Palestinians call it. But never really hearing sort of how Palestinians would feel about those locations or what they would tell you about those locations, because you didn't. Of course, your guide's not going to give you that history. I'm thinking specifically about, for example, Nahal Gavrim, which is the site of Beit Jibrin, which is a Palestinian village that was depopulated in 1948 after the ceasefire. A week after the ceasefire was depopulated. So while you're telling me all this, I'm imagining myself walking with this guide, and, you know, I'd be like stopping him, like, wait a minute, did you tell her about did you tell her at the Western Wall that there used to be the Moroccan quarter here? That's that big space that's in front of the, you know. And did you tell her that Ben Gurion's a war criminal, that he's the one that planned for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine? I mean, you know, I can hear myself because in fact, I was with a group when I went to the Hebrew University for a summer session. I was with a group, and they took me to some of these places to show me, you know, this is why we need the state of Israel. And they took me to Yad Vashem, and they said, see this Palestinian Haj Amin al-Husseini, you know, meeting with Hitler. So that's why. And I'm just saying, well, what does that mean, that you have the right to get rid of all of the Palestinians in Palestine because you had this one figure, you know, that met with this person, or you had the persecution in Europe? Does that justify, like, clearing us out of this? You know, I couldn't understand why he thought that all of a sudden this person that was taking me from my group at school, why he thought that was supposed to be, like, an eye-opener for me, you know?
Yeah.
So I wondered, I just wondered if the guide at all gave you some of that.
Not at Beit Gavrin, and he actually, in his defense, didn't go with us to the Ben-Gurion gravesite. I don't think he was particularly fond of some of the things that Ben-Gurion did, but in later conversations. But that was kind of a thing with my family.
He's considered, just like we have our founding fathers that probably have colored, checkered histories too, you know, right?
Yeah.
He's considered pretty standard fare of any good nationalist Israeli.
But some of it, Zaha, is that when you're inside the Zionist narrative, it's very compelling.
No, yeah. It is.
It's incredibly compelling. It's quite an epic story. It's quite dramatic.
Mm-hmm. It is dramatic.
And therefore, the questions about was there a depopulated Palestinian village or 500 depopulated Palestinian villages, again, it doesn't fit into the narrative, and therefore it's not even a footnote to the story. So I'd be very surprised if Bonnie heard anything about that on this tour, because again, the narrative builds to a crescendo, and the crescendo is the celebration of this incredible accomplishment of the State of Israel. And the Palestinians, again, they're sort of just in the way.
But they're so key to, you know, these tours that, like the Birthright tours, it's very, very methodical in what they show you. And it culminates in the end, from what I hear from friends, you know, with showing just how small and tiny the country is. Therefore, we can't, you know, and we're surrounded by all these other Arab countries and they are all after us. So we've got to do these things that we do, you know. And unfortunately, so many of our elected officials get taken on these trips, too, with the AIPAC, with the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, where they get the same sort of tour. And never see, like Bonnie did, the Palestinian narrative as well. So speaking of that, then.
Well, one other thing I have to say about our guide, because he was more nuanced, was he really wanted us to see the wall.
The wall.
He did. He took us to places where we could see the wall.
And what did he say about that?
He felt bad about there being a wall. He was not happy about it.
So we should be clear. There are two walls. Yeah. There's the Wailing Wall, which,
I'm sorry,
of course, is a holy site. And then
not
the
Wailing
describing.
Wall. I'm talking about the separation barrier. Yeah. Is that the right word?
Well, yeah, there's different names for it, depending on who you're talking to.
Which I call the wall, because it reminds me of the Berlin Wall. But
yeah.
But the separation barrier. And he also talked about the settlements and was very uncomfortable about them. So he did share some of his discomfort about what Israel
really
was
good.
Doing. And he did it kind of slowly and gradually. I don't think he wanted to bias us at the beginning. He wanted about who he was, but he was pretty open-minded and uncomfortable about a number of things Israel was doing politically.
So then you left for Jordan, which was you had a great trip to Petra,
we won't
go into that because...
Right. Petra, Wadi Rum.
Yeah.
And we were with a Jordanian guide at that point.
Right. And then you came back through the Allenby Bridge,
we sure
right?
did. And so, that was quite an experience.
Very different than coming through Ben-Gurion Airport, right?
Yes.
So tell us about coming through...
Allenby is an experience, and I was pretty angry while I was going through it, but...
Why angry?
Because we were treated with disdain and disrespect.
By
the people who were in charge, who I believe were Israelis.
Mm-hmm. Why would they treat you that way, though, I wonder,
because
coming through Allenby?
Because I think they treat everybody that way coming through Allenby. I think you're kind of like a little ant.
Yeah.
And for me, I have artificial knees. I have knee replacements. So we went through, and so the whole thing took us 3 hours. And when we came out, we talked to the Palestinian guide who met us there, and he said, 3 hours, that's nothing. I was there for 12 hours.
Yeah, that's true.
So it gave us a context about how people were treated, how long they were delayed.
And it's not very typical, actually, to have Israelis or Jews go through Allenby. They usually go through the Sheikh Hassan Bridge, which is up north. Mm-hmm. So you were probably viewed as a solidarity, a Palestinian solidarity person. So mm-hmm. that might have been why you weren't so well received.
It's true that
I've been there for 8 to 12 hours doing nothing but sitting and sitting and waiting and waiting. So I agree with you. It's not the funnest travel experience.
No. And, you know, there were a couple nice people. You had to show your passport like, I don't know, what, eight times or six times, something like that, over and over again. There were one or two nice people, but the rest of the people could care less, and they really showed it. So it was a real, you know, in retrospect, we were actually very happy that we had that experience, because it showed us how people could be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very different than the Ben-Gurion Airport, where everybody was very solicitous, actually, mm-hmm. you know, to us. You know, have a great day, have a wonderful trip, your knees are fine, you know. This was very different.
Yeah.
Sit there, you know, stop moving. And when I tried to gesture to my husband, the guy stood in between the two of us so we couldn't talk to each other. And our luggage was just thrown all over the place. Everybody's luggage was thrown all over the place. There was complete disregard. And it was very sloppy. Everything was sloppy. There was none of this kind of Israeli efficiency that you hear about. Right. It was really...
It is a big contrast between the Ben-Gurion Airport, because you've got the air conditioning, the beautiful limestone shining all around you, and then you go through the Allenby, and it's like, wow, you feel like you got the Harlem Globetrotters throwing your luggage around, and you're just like treated like you're, you know, with hostility, really.
And actually, the Palestinian driver who worked with the Siraj Center, where... who was the group that was taking us around. We only had him for that evening, and he drove us to Ramallah, and he was like our savior. He was so kind, and can I get you something to drink? And, you know, the what I've read and heard about Palestinian people is they have incredible generosity and hospitality, and he really showed it to us. And after going through Allenby, here was this Palestinian man who just kind of scooped us up and took us in and was so gracious and kind. And
then what was your experience coming in? Because you've traveled there. You went to Palestine later with a group from Oregon, right? Where did you come in from, and how was your experience coming into the country?
Well, I can give you two experiences. One is the group from Oregon that I went with. It was during the First Intifada, which was back in the, I think, 89 is when we went. And it was a group of Christians, Muslims, and Jews going to meet with people on all sides. We met with Israeli Jews as well as Palestinians. And we had no problem whatsoever because we flew into Ben-Gurion Airport. But there was another trip where I entered also from Jordan across the Allenby Bridge. And there I, too, had a similar situation to what you're describing, Bonnie, where my shoes were taken off and sent somewhere for inspection and all kinds of things like that. But I would love to jump into your West Bank experience. Mm-hmm. So you've gotten through the Allenby Bridge already. And tell us what you experienced in the West Bank as a Jewish American.
Well, it was really interesting because I'd read about Belin. Before I went there, and I thought, oh, Belin's a hot spot. We're not going to go there. And so I was really surprised when, first of all, we were surprised for Ramallah. It was a very cosmopolitan city, lots of people in business attire, and, you know, it was a real happening place. So we were very pleasantly surprised by that. We stayed in a nice hotel, and then we got picked up and taken right away to Belin, where I thought we wouldn't go. And not only did we go to a place where there are demonstrations, but we went to the home of one of the people who organized the demonstrations. So that was really a surprise. And he was wonderful. He was wonderful. It was, I'm going to forget his name.
Iyad Bernat.
Yeah. And his brother made the film that got nominated for an Academy Award.
Iyad Bernat.
Five Broken Cameras.
Did you get to meet him as well?
I did not meet him, and I didn't see his film till I returned home. Mm-hmm. But we did see some videotape footage of the man from that town, Belin, being killed by a short-range... I'm trying to remember, a tear gas canister. Mm-hmm. So it was really moving to hear him talk. And he was exhausted. He'd just come back from three months, I think, in the United States touring. But that was a real wake-up call to me to see what harassment the Palestinians in Belin and other towns have to go through with people interrupting them in the middle of the night, waking up their kids, no good reason, just harassment. Doing a nonviolent protest and being hit by tear gas canisters.
You actually saw the protests?
I didn't see the protests. I saw the footage of it.
Oh, just the footage, okay.
Yeah.
But you saw the wall that's constructed on there.
That's right.
In village land.
That's right.
Yeah. You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. And our guest today is Bonnie Reagan, who recently returned from the West Bank and from Israel and is recounting some of her journey. So I would be really interested in hearing more, Bonnie, about the contradictions or the places where you perhaps felt confused hearing mm-hmm. an Israeli Jewish perspective and then hearing a Palestinian perspective, and where there was conflict not only between the perspectives but also in perhaps the, inside you.
Yeah. Being on each side of the wall, being on the Israeli side of the wall, where the separation barrier, where the wall is to the side, but you've got all this other land, and then being in the West Bank, where the wall is very constricting, and you feel hemmed in and trapped, was a very physical, visceral realization about how the two different groups live. And that was something that you just really felt. Pete and I both felt that being hemmed in feeling.
Was it surprising to you that the wall isn't on a border between Israel
yes.
and that it's actually in the middle of...
That's right. That was a surprise, too, that more and more land is being taken because of where the wall's being built. That's on the land that's supposed to be part of the West Bank for the Palestinians. So the Israelis are getting more and more land for Israel.
Did that make you question the security justification for the wall by then seeing where it is actually being built?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. So I think seeing, we went to Aida Refugee Camp in Bethlehem. We went to Jericho, Bethlehem, Ramallah. I know there's other places.
I believe you went to Hebron.
Hebron, definitely. Oh, yeah. So just seeing the way people are being forced to live. And
tell us about Hebron, because that's a really special case in Palestine.
Hebron, you know, we saw the street that was, there was a very busy main market street that was...
where they have the souk, yeah.
Yeah, where they have the souk that was cut off, partitioned by the Israeli Defense Forces. And I guess one thing that's important to say is that we were told that the Israeli Defense Forces actually manage the West Bank and not the Israeli politicians.
It's a military
occupation, right. So that was kind of shocking to see the main commercial area of Hebron so messed up. But I think even more than that, we did go into a market in Hebron, and there was a netting over a wire netting. Did you see that, Ned? Over the marketplace.
Yes. Yes.
And the merchant that we talked to that we bought some stuff from showed us how the Israelis who lived above the Palestinian market would throw garbage and eggs and trash and stones down on top. And if they didn't have a netting to catch some of this, people would be very injured.
And how are they living there? I mean, how is it that they came to be living in the middle of the Palestinian town? You're talking about the Israelis?
Yeah, they settled there. There's settlers, a settlement right? there. Yeah, there's a settlement right in Hebron.
And I don't know if the listeners are going to know, but how many settlers are there in living? Do you remember? Because you had written about it. And I think it's like around 400 or 500 that are living in the middle of Palestinian
Hebron.
And there's no, yeah. there's in the West Bank, there isn't really that situation. The settlements are usually off on an elevated
part of the land
around a Palestinian village. But in the city or town of Hebron, you've got 400 who are supported by 1,500 to 2,000 Israeli soldiers.
Defense forces,
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's important for our listeners to know that all of these settlements, and there now are about 650,000 Israeli Jews in these settlements in the West Bank, all of them are illegal under international law.
Right. And I did talk to my cousin about that, who said that that Israel didn't recognize that international law. Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway, being in that marketplace, seeing eggs that were dripped down on people's things that they were selling and ruin it, stones, some of the big chunks of cement that were thrown down, it was really horrifying.
Did you say that you have family that are living in settlements too?
No, I don't.
No, no you don't.
Ned does.
You do. Okay.
I do.
And so have you been to this inside of a settlement? And so you must know like how the settlers think about their relationship to the Palestinian community that they're living.
Yeah, for me, it was quite a juxtaposition, because the previous trip that I shared with you, that I was in Israel-Palestine during the First Intifada, and we heard from lots of Palestinian solidarity activists during that trip. After that was over, I stayed on for a while and went to visit my cousin in Gilo, which is a large settlement very close to Bethlehem. And, you know, it's a self-contained sort of siege mentality, fortress kind of community where it's Jewish only, and there are exclusive roads that only Jews can ride on in the West Bank. And, you know, my cousin is, you know, perhaps more progressive than many. I don't think that she spews hatred about, you know, her neighbors and the Palestinian villages nearby, but it was very clear that she was on a mission, like the settlers. Many of them, especially when they're religious, as my cousin is, believe that they're reclaiming this land and that this is their God-given right. So it was, you know, very, very disturbing to hear that, you know, these God-given rights supersede international law and recent history. You know, because to her, since 2,000 years ago, Jews lived in that area. They had a right to come back. But 65 years ago, Palestinians lived in that area. And of course, they have no right to come back. So those were some of the contradictions that were very disturbing.
Yeah.
Does she ever come in contact with Palestinians living in Gilo? Because they do have a separate road system, and they are able to go in and out of the West Bank as though that they've never left Israel, because there's really no way of knowing, right? That you are in Israel or you're in Palestine when you're in the settlements and using the settlement roads.
Right, and I think this is one of the issues that makes people that still advocate for a two-state solution have a real hard time, and that is that Israel has, in a sense, taken over such an enormous part of the West Bank and incorporated it into Israel, so that, as you're saying, there are roads that lead directly from Tel Aviv or Jerusalem out to the settlements, so that you can be living in a settlement, but you don't interact with Palestinians. You interact with other Israeli Jews.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was one of the most striking things for me, is that there was really a complete separation, unless somebody made a big attempt to go to the other side, and that there was, you know, the Israelis didn't go to Jordan. They didn't go to the West Bank. They lived in Israel, and they were, in a way, they're trapped as well.
Yeah, right.
And then the Palestinians are more trapped, because they're not allowed out in a lot of, most of the time. And I mean, we did see at the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, actually some of those young people did travel to other places, New York, Massachusetts. They did get out and show some of their creativity, their art, theater that they were learning in the refugee camp. But in general, people were pretty trapped, and nobody knew. One side didn't know the other side. There's a complete separation.
It's kind of interesting, just a footnote, but near Aida is Azza refugee camp, which is also known as Beit Jibrin refugee camp. So if you had gone to, instead of going to Aida, if you'd gone to Azza, you would have actually met the families of those that were displaced and from the village that you had visited, where the archaeological dig was. Mm-hmm. You would have met some of the family of the people.
Wow,
there.
That would have been interesting.
There's always these ironies when you travel to, you know, Israel and Palestine, because it's just, you know, it's everywhere. Everywhere you turn.
Everywhere. Yeah.
So, Bonnie, you're a lifelong human rights and peace advocate and activist. How do you, as a Jewish American, make sense of all that you just recently experienced and all the reading you've done ever since returning to the U.S.?
Well, it's interesting. I realized when I was over there that I had an elevated view of Jews, in the sense I've always been interested in ethics, and when I was in Hebrew school, I actually studied a lot of ethics. So I thought of us as being ethical people, and again, my lesson from the Holocaust was, you treat all people with respect and dignity. You don't trample on anybody's civil rights or human rights. So to find out that, you know, Jews are just as complex and good/bad as everybody else, I mean, it's obvious because we're all human beings, but it took a, you know, it changed my idea a little bit. And I think it's because I hold myself to a high standard. My parents were very ethical people. So that was kind of part of my image of who I was and where I came from. And to find that, you know, we're just as complex and prone to corruption as everybody else. Even at my ancient age of 67, it took a tumble. So that was part of it. The other part of it was seeing really what looks like oppression and harassment is very upsetting. And even though I'm not a practicing Jew and that I don't go to synagogue, I still celebrate some of the holidays. And I still have that connection from all those years of education and my being around my grandparents and my parents. It was very disturbing to come back and try to figure out who I was. I mean, am I a Jew or am I not? You know, and what I realized is that I have to reclaim the piece of Judaism that feels right to me. And to be able to say, well, this is the kind of Jew that I am. And for me, it's mostly cultural, historical. It's not so much religious, but I just believe that the values that I have, which I think are in many religions and many cultures, are the ones that I need to hang on to and to be able to express.
Do you think part of this discomfort is because it's been the job that was done in sort of conflating Israel with Judaism and being Jewish has been so profound on you that now you feel like you can't be Jewish and be not supportive of what's going on in Israel? I mean, it seems
like
that's
the part of it. Yeah,
maybe you can be just as Jewish as you've always been, but you just need to, you know, need to reinterpret what that means in connection to Israel. And that's what this whole conversation is that we're having.
And it's not just Israel. It's also different branches of Judaism. I'm being around ultra-Orthodox Jews was difficult for me as well. So it's not, and they're kind of in their own world in Jerusalem. But just seeing that, I can't identify with that myself. Mm-hmm. So I do have to kind of, as you say, reclaim the part of me that's me and separate out all the other pieces and see where I fit. And part of it is speaking out a bit against injustice. That's how I was raised. I was raised to be ethical and to care about peace and justice. And so as a person who was raised Jewish, I need to speak out about injustices that I see in Israel as well as other places.
Just as you would in the U.S., right? As an American.
Right.
And there's
right.
nothing wrong with that.
That's
I
right.
think that's the problem that we see is that you feel like, whereas you could criticize America any day of the week, and we all do, you know, Jewish Americans feel like they can't criticize Israel, and it seems odd.
Yeah. Well, this is a really complicated and really interesting point because when I was growing up, there really was this total meshing together of Jews and Judaism and Israel and Zionism and the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And it was virtually impossible to know where one ended and the other began. They were so interwoven. Mm-hmm. So if somebody criticized Israel, mm-hmm. we knew that they were an anti-Semite because mm-hmm. it was all part of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our challenge, at least I feel like my challenge, is in pulling those things apart, which can be very wrenching. It's our redemption. In a way, it's the thing that gives us hope, mm-hmm. because in pulling apart the stuff that really doesn't fit together, and a political ideology, as in Zionism, really doesn't, to me, fit in with the Jewish traditions and learnings that I was brought up with.
Mm-hmm.
And when I can separate things out, then I have this really liberating opportunity to find myself again as a Jew, proud of where I stand, and as you're saying, Bonnie, identifying with the strong commandment within Judaism is to stand for justice.
That's right.
So a big part of Judaism that I learned was you stand with the oppressed and you call out the oppressor.
That's right.
And that's what's so empowering when we begin to walk down this road of being Jewish, and supporting the Palestinian struggle for justice.
That's right. I agree with you.
So what have each of you, what do you feel like is the next step once you've come to this realization, right? What do you feel like your next mission is? Is there one? Is it just coming to terms with it yourself? Is it to talking to your family about it? Or is that just really too difficult for you? And how was that for you, Ned?
For me, ever since I've been back, I've been reading, everything I've been reading has been about the Palestinian and Israel conflict. So I've been reading Palestinian books. I've been reading Israeli books about the history and about what's going on now. So I'm trying to learn more, and I wrote emails to not only my family, but a lot of friends about what I experienced in the West Bank and in Allenby. And so I'm trying to help other people think through things more. I know I've had some effect because a friend of mine whose brother lives in Israel says she didn't want to go to Israel, and now she's willing to think about it. Same reasons that I had for not wanting to go and then deciding to go.
And will she want to see the other side?
Oh, yes, she will. She will, mm-hmm,
oh,
for
great.
Sure. And then the other thing is I'm reading things online. So I have the Rabbis for Human Rights website and the Jewish Voice for Peace website. I'm also reading some of the other stuff that I don't like, the Palestinian Media Watch, which is, you know, it's very biased, but I'm trying to learn more about what people's points of view are. And then when people suggest that we take an action, I'm trying to do some of those actions.
And Ned, how was it for you coming back from, you know, your trips and then figuring out what you want to do?
Well, for me, I think what was most important was feeling at the deepest level that our responsibility as humans and as citizens of this planet is to criticize injustice wherever and whenever we see it. And that criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitic. That, in fact, it's our Jewish obligation to strive for justice. And for me, I think that it's a matter of conscience. You know, mm-hmm. It's not anti-Semitism at all if you fight for justice. As a matter of fact, it's a very strong and affirming act of conscience. And it's quite energizing to be able, finally, in my life, to put the pieces back together, which allow me to live my life based on my values.
But can you talk to your family still? Can you, you know?
Well, it depends which members of my family.
Are they still all in your life, the ones that were very Zionist in their background, knowing how you feel about the situation?
No, actually, it's a very tense conversation, and that's not unlike many Jewish families right now. There's somewhat of a civil war going on within the Jewish community itself over this very issue, and there are obviously my family and my parents believe that in coming out strongly in support of justice for Palestine and for Palestinians, that I'm undermining and really turning my back on the Jewish people. When in fact, I have a strong belief that it's just the opposite, that I'm not turning my back on the Jewish people. I'm reaffirming my connection to Jews and to Judaism and its values.
And Bonnie, have you had any changes in your relationships because of your thinking now, or have you not really had an opportunity to talk to family that may have had been on one side of this strongly?
I haven't yet had an opportunity to get into deeper conversations with my cousins in the United States. But, you know, I have had conversations with my cousins in Israel, and I've sent them some of my emails, and I don't know exactly what they think, but I know that my cousin started looking for one of the Amos Oz books that I mentioned, where she hadn't done that before. So I guess one other thing I want to say is I think there's a lot of fear, and I think it's fear that's holding people back. That fear of getting to know the other needs to be addressed, and we need to stand up for all of us getting to know each other better.
You've been listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM. We've been speaking with Bonnie Reagan, Portland physician and peace activist, about her recent trip to Palestine, Israel. Thank you, Bonnie, for sharing so beautifully. Your story and that of many other Jews who are discovering ways to take a stand fundamentally for human rights and equality in this conflict are important, inspiring, and challenge all of us to struggle for justice in all of Israel-Palestine. So on behalf of Zaha Hassan and myself, Ned Roche, thank you for listening. Peace. ودي اغني نسمتين حريه والحلم طاهر في الضماير عاش.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 10 a.m. Coming up on this morning on KBOO is Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an update on the Bradley Manning trial. At 11, Rosalie Regal talks about her life as an oral historian and activist and her book, Doing Time for Peace, Resistance, Family, and Community, which is based on interviews with peace activists who have spent time in jails and prisons. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for Community Progressive Radio. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm. Click on Donate Today. Now this.
Do you love listening to KBOO? Want to get involved in the great programming you hear? Become a volunteer. KBOO's volunteer orientation will be Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m., located at Southeast 8th and Ankeny in Portland. Questions can be directed to Ani at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or by email at volunteer@kboo.org.